This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The past few sedras have been very full of people calling names to all sorts of things. People calling names to people, and people calling names to places, and people calling names to objects such as the wells, which we had 2 weeks ago. And I want to look a little bit at the meaning of a name. What does it mean when it says, we call such and such so and so? Why does the Torah spend so much time and effort on telling us what names were used for various things and on what the reason for giving that particular name? The very first cases we have in the Torah of giving things names is in the very beginning of the Torah, in Bereshit, where it's the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, in fact, who gives names to various items. And let's start there to try and understand a little bit what it's all about. On the first day, God creates light and darkness. Vayara Elohim et ha'or ki tov, and God saw that the light was good, and he separated between the light and the darkness. Vayikra Elohim lo'or yoin v'lachoshech koro laila. And he doesn't leave it being called dark and light. He calls darkness laila, nighttime, and he calls light daytime. He gives it a name. The next case is in the same day when he creates the rakia. Firmament, as they translated in English, whatever that means. And it's separated between the waters underneath and the waters on top. Vayikra Elohim la rakia shomayim. And God called the rakia shomayim. Again, he wasn't satisfied with it being called the rakia. He gave it a special name by which it was afterwards known. Then he separates the dry land and the water. Vayikra Elohim la yabosho eretz v'mikveh hamayim kol hayamim. And he calls the dry land eretz, and the sea, the water, he calls yam, sea. So there are five things which God names in the 6 days of Bereshit, of creation. He names heaven, he names light, dark, the sky, water and dry land, sea and earth. Those are the only occasions we know of in the Torah that the Ribbono Shel Olam actually gives a name to something. Says you, it will not be called this, but it will be called this. Let's try and understand why. The Targum Yonatan, for example, in the first case, it translates the following. Ukara Hashem Linahoira Yonmama Va'avde Lemiflach Be Daire Alma. This is now a translation, don't forget, not an interpretation. And God called light day and made it a time for humanity to work. V'lachashoicha Kora Lelia, and the darkness he called nighttime, Laila, Va'avde Lemenach Be Briyoto, and he made it a time for people to sleep, to rest. Where does the Targum Yonatan get that in the words? In the Chumash, all we're told is that God calls that light day and he calls darkness night. Where does the Targum Yonatan get these extra words which he inserts as translation, not as interpretation? That what it means is daytime to working and nighttime to resting. The Targum Yonatan is in fact translating the words yom and the words laila. And Hirsch proves it also dramatically. That yom is connected to the word kum, standing upright. It's a time for activity. That's what yom means. And laila comes from the word lo, which means lying down, quiet, resting, horizontal. Therefore, the Targum Yonatan is quite right. The Targum Yonatan is translating these new words, yom and laila. Yom is a period of time during which it is light and during which one is meant to be active. Laila is a period of time during which it is dark and during which one is meant to be inactive and relaxed and rest. That's what yom means, and that's what laila means. So God takes the word oir, which means light in general, and he gives it a name which teaches us the specific use of that light. Oir is not oir, it's not light, it's yom, it's time to work. That's what oir means. So we begin to see already a little bit what a name is meant to do. A name is meant to describe, it would appear, the function of the thing you're naming. Yom is a time to work, and Layla is a time to sleep. The Rakia, the Kleyasa, says that God didn't want the Rakia left as Rakia because there's a connotation of separateness in the word Rakia, because he introduced the Rakia to separate between the bottom waters and the top waters, whatever that means, I don't understand it, but that's what it was. And that the thing that was created, in fact, on this day was separateness, and the Rakia represents that separateness, and God didn't want the Rakia to go by the name that connects it with separateness, with machlokes, with splitting, because he's trying to make things work and to make things fit together, not to pull things apart and not to separate them. And therefore he gives the Rakia the name Shamayim, which Rashi says means various things, Shamayim or Samayim, basically to show that in the Rakia in fact carries water. Let's take Rakia in its simplest meaning at the moment and take it to mean the air above the ground, right? Everything from here till the top of the atmosphere, which contains the water, which ultimately becomes rain. There's a certain moisture in the air. So you've got moisture which is underground, or moisture which is on the ground or underground, and then in addition to that you have moisture which is actually held in the air, right? And that's Shamayim. What's the principle of naming then? You see, there's another principle in naming. That when you name something, name it after its positive aspect. I'll say a little bit more about that soon. And then the sea and the dry land. He calls the dry land Eretz. Explains the Ramban, what does he mean by that? Says the Ramban, he's already said in the beginning, in the very first verse, in the beginning God created Shamayim, et ha-Shamayim ve'et ha-Aretz, heaven and earth. That means there are basically two things. There's heaven, the world of the spiritual, and there's Aretz, the world of the physical. Those are the two things which existed and which God created. Now by saying that the dry land is Aretz, says the Ramban, the Torah is in fact telling you that everything for which the world was created, that means the physical world, is all going to take place on dry land. Don't get carried away with the sea. It's true that it covers more than half of the globe. It's true that it's very impressive and it's very attractive. But don't think that's where it's all going to happen. On the Yabosha, on the dry land, that's Eretz. When we talk about Eretz, the world, we're talking about the dry land. That's where it's all going to happen. That's where the whole Eretz is going to function. And Yam, says the Rabbeinu Bechaya, that Yam really means a cavity. A cavity. We're told that Yam, he called the water Yam, which means a cavity filled with water. In other words, he wants you to understand that when you look at the sea, don't just see the surface. Don't just see the water. You've got to understand what it really is. It's a cavity filled with water. We'll come back to these names in a very brief moment, but I want to move to the next major preoccupation with names, which is after God decides that Avram needs a wife. It says, and God brought all the animals of the field which he had formed to Adam, Lirot ma yikro lo, to see what will Adam call these things. They didn't have names yet, they were just called animals. They weren't broken up into their species. And God wanted to see what Adam would call these animals. V'chol asher yikro loy ha-Adam nefesh chaya hu shumor. And anything which this man, this living human being, would call him, hu shumor, that would be its name. Then it says, Adam called names to all the animals, and didn't find a wife. Says the Sipurna, what does it mean, Lirois Ma Yitro Lo? כדי שיראה ויסבוינן איזה שם רואי לכל אחד מהם. In order that he should perceive and understand deeply what name is suited to each single animal. He had to undertake a major study of zoology, understand the essence of every single animal, name each one suitably, appropriately, according to what? כפי הפעולו המיוחדת לצורתו. He had to name each one according to the activity which is unique to its particular form. And this is a fantastic tikkun, because he defines what a name is supposed to do, what a noun is supposed to do. Adam has to be roye v'yizboinen, eze shem roye l'kol echod mehem, what name is suitable for each individual one of them, כפי הפעולה המיוחדת לצורתו, according to the activities unique to that particular form. That's what he had to do. In other words, he had to study the form of each animal, he had to study the zoology of each animal, and figure out by the zoology of the animal what its function in the world was, and to name it according to its function. That's what he had to do. And that's what naming a thing is. Going back now to the five names which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave to those five items in Bereshit, we see that it's correct in fact so. Light and dark doesn't tell us about what we're meant to use light and dark for. On the contrary, we might think that dark is a frightening time and a dangerous time and a terrible time. So we're told, no, Choshech, the darkness he calls Laila, it's a time to rest. He's telling us that by studying the essence of dark, you'll understand that that's a time to rest, and we name it according to its pe'ulo amiyuchedes letzurotoy, its unique function in the world. That's by which we name it. What is unique about nighttime? What makes nighttime different from daytime? And Amaoret says the light is off, it's dark. That's what a superficial person says. What's the difference between night and day? It's dark in the night and it's light in the day. That's not the deep difference. The deep difference is that nighttime is a time for rest and daytime is a time for activity. That's what night means and that's what daytime means. The Rakia. Come to the Rakia, the same thing. Don't be put by the negative aspect of the Rakia. The fact that it's separate. Because the essence of the Rakia is not the separation, but the fact that it holds water. The fact that it holds the mayim, the upper waters, which ultimately come down in the form of rain, of dew, of the snow, frost, whatever it is. It's essential to the correct functioning of the world. So don't look at Rakia for what it appears to be on the surface. Look at the Rakia for what it really is, what its function is. Its function is not to split. That's what it did in action. But its function is to hold the water. And therefore, when naming the Rakia, God gives the name, Sa-Mayim, the bearer of water. That's what the Rakia really is. That's what Shamayim really is. So there's a warning here to see what the thing is in essence and not to name it superficially. And when naming it, to name it after its strength, not after its weakness. Everything and everybody has strengths and weaknesses. And one can go further and say that every person has a strength and a weakness. There's one basic strength and one basic weakness. And we can go still one step further and we can say every person's weakness is his strength. The strength mishandled causes him his weakness. A weakness handled correctly is in fact his strength. So you'll find a man whose strength might be that he is very generous. He can part with money easily. That's a fantastic strength, but it's a weakness as well. You'll find his weaknesses in the same area. You'll find a man whose strength is that he's a tremendous extrovert. Gets on with people and everything's fantastic. That's a wonderful strength, but that can also be a weakness. That he doesn't have time for himself, that he isn't deep, that he doesn't penetrate, that everything is too superficial. You can have a man who's got a wonderful intellect, but you can find that he's so intellectual that he never feels anything. And you'll always find, not usually, but always, find that a man's weakness and his strength are in the same area. And the weakness is a misused strength, and the strength is a misused weakness. And God warns us, when you're naming something, when you're defining something, there's nothing which is negative. You might look at the Rakia and say, that's separation. And in fact, it doesn't use the word Ki Tov on the second day because the Rakia was created. It doesn't say, and God saw that it was good. Because there's an aspect of the second day which God doesn't like, so to say. There is this division on the second day, and God doesn't feel comfortable in the presence of division. So it doesn't say Ki Tov. So says the Ribbono Shel Olam, nevertheless, when you name it, when you try and figure out what the Rakia is, don't look at its weakness, look at its strength, and call it after its strength. It's Shomayim, it's not Rakia. And then comes Eretz, the same thing. Don't think that it's just dry land. It is dry land, but you've got to understand that that dry land is Eretz. It's where it's all happening. And Yam, look below the surface. Don't just see water. A sea is not water. A sea is a cavity filled with water. And if a man says that a sea is water, then he's superficial. He doesn't understand. He's not looking deeply enough. He's just looking on the surface. What's that? It's water. It's not water. It's a Yam. And a Yam is a mikra, as the Torah in fact calls it, l'mikvei ha-mayim koro yomim. One sees it as a mikra. It's a mikra, it's a kosher mikra, it's got a boil, it's got it's dug out, it's filled with kosher mikra water. That's what a sea is. One has to see it in its correct perspective to understand properly what it is. And we're warned, when you name something, don't go by what it appears to be. You must go by what it is really. You must see below the surface. And if you look below the surface of the water, you'll find a cavity filled with water and with fish and with coral and with all sorts of wonderful things. And that's what a yam is. A yam is not just water. That's what it is to name something. If that's what it is to name something, then we have a great deal of difficulty with many, many names. I just haven't had the time to go right through all the names. We'll do it sometime, but one can treat virtually all the namings in the Torah on a similar line. In the beginning it told us when Yaakov and Esau were born, Vayetze Horisho in Admoini Kule Ka'adere Seo. This is in Bereshit chapter 25 verse 25. And the first one came out all covered, red and all covered in hair, Vayikru Shemoi Esav. And everybody called him Esav. Esav meaning complete. He's physically complete. Says Rashi, Koroloi came, they called him this, Lefi Shehoyo Nase V'nigmar Bisaroi Kven Shonim Harbe. He looked physically mature already. He was born with a degree of physical maturity. And Esav means complete, fully made, ready made. And Yaakov, what was with Yaakov? Va'acharechein, and afterwards, Yotso Ochi V'yodo Yerchezit Ba'akev Esav. His brother came out and his hand was holding at the ankle of Esav. V'yitra Shemoi Yaakov. And he called his name Yaakov, from Ochi, from ankle. Now I ask you, if naming is so important, and we mustn't be fooled by the surface, and we must get to the essence of what the function of the person is or the thing is in the world. And don't think that a sea is water, a sea is yam. And don't think that the dry land is dry land, it's air. And daytime is yamama, it's a time to work. And nighttime is layla, it's a time to rest. Name it by what it is in essence. I ask you, how superficial can one get as to name Esav, Esav because he looks like Esav, and Yaakov, Yaakov because he's hanging onto the ankle of Yaakov? What more superficial name giving could there have been? And one goes right through the names, many of them are so superficial. But these are striking as to how superficial they are. The others are at least a bit emotional. When you go through the 12 tribes, even there it's a little bit disturbing that each mother names the child in the way she herself felt at the time of the birth, or the way she felt about the birth. God did this for me, and I see, and it's very personal. Okay, that's difficult enough to understand, but this is altogether superficial. To give a child a name, Yaakov, because he was hanging onto an ankle, I mean, imagine in English. There weren't names, these were new names. They weren't traditional names. So imagine calling a child ankle. Why do you call him ankle? Because he was hanging onto the ankle of his twin brother. That's it, ankle, ankle, the same. And Esav, the same thing. Esav, to call him Esav, why is he Esav? Because he came out looking complete. It's unbelievable. And worse than that, Esav, look, it says Vayikru Ushamo Esav. Says Rashi, and they called his name Esav. Hakol Koru Loken. Everybody called him that. That just became his name. As he came out, everybody said Esav. So he stuck with the name. So maybe I can understand that it wasn't really his parents who gave him that name. That's what everybody called him, and that remained his name. But you know who gave him the name Yaakov? There are two views in Rashi. The one is Vayikru Ushamo Yaakov, and he called him Yaakov. Who's he? Says Rashi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God called him Yaakov. God, why did you call him Yaakov? Because he was hanging on to the anchor. It doesn't make sense. And the other view is that Yitzchak called him Yaakov. Whichever way it is, it's difficult to understand. That anybody, certainly the Ribbono Shel'olam himself, should call a child Yaakov because he was hanging on to an anchor, that's very difficult to understand. I want to explain a concept to you which some of you have already heard a couple of years ago, and this is not really the whole subject of the shiur, which in any case is not going to be a long shiur, and I don't want to get involved in this concept which I'm going to explain to you. I merely want to explain it to you briefly, just to use it to understand what's going on here. But it's a very exciting concept and a very essential concept. Hirsch points out in the second thing we looked at, and God brought the animals and the birds and everything to Adam to see what he would call them. And everything which man, the living being, will call him, that is his name. That's how Hirsch translates it. I must say, I haven't found anybody else that translates it that way, but I'm sure Hirsch has got a source for this. He wouldn't say it otherwise. So let's see, let's handle Hirsch's translation, because that's the only one that's important for the purpose of this discussion. And anything which man, the human being, would call the animal, hushmoy, that is its name. What does that mean? Says Hirsch, we are told here that although Adam is only a human being, and although he can't understand the absolute essence of every animal that's going to come before him, did he really climb into the Ribbono Shel'olam's mind and figure out exactly what God had in mind when he created this animal? That's not possible. At best, he can simply name him on the basis of the way that he responds to the animal, the way he sees the animal functioning. Says Hirsch, translating the Chumash, "V'chol asher yikra bo ha'adam nefesh chaya," although Adam is only a living being, Hushemoy, that is his real name. I want to translate it slightly differently, just to stress differently. The translation is the same, and the meaning is similar, but the color is different. The way Hirsch translates it is, "V'chol asher yikra lo ha'adam," anything which man calls him, nefesh chaya, even though he's only a human being, Hushemoy, that will be the name. I want to translate it this way. And whatever man is going to call him, Nefesh Chaya, because man is a living being, is a human being, in terms of the way we define Nefesh Chaya at the Chumashir 2 weeks ago, Hushemoy, that is his name. So Nefesh Chaya meaning not even though he's only human, but Nefesh Chaya meaning because he's human, that will be his name. Be that as it may, we see one thing from here, and that is that the Ribbono Shel'olam is satisfied that we are competent to give them the correct name. How can we give the correct name? How is it possible even for a parent to give the correct name to a child? In giving names to children, one has to discover the name, not make up the name. The child is born with a name, and the parents have to have special siyata d'shmaya to discover the right name. How is it possible to find a name? And certainly in a situation like Adam, where he had to name every animal according to the way the Sipurna says, he's got to put his finger on the unique function of that particular animal. There is a principle that we've got to extend our vision a little bit. Let me put it to you this way. When I used to be a rabbi in Stellenbosch, I had a certain balabos who was a farmer. And he and his children, he had several sons and his wife, very seldom used to leave the farm. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur they used to leave. I think that was about all. Everything was on the farm. They never went into town, never off the farm. And once I had to go there to sort out a family problem, and I came back emotionally absolutely drained. And my wife said to me, what happened? What goes on there? You look as if it was quite exciting. And I said, I've never seen such a thing. These people don't know that there's Cape Town down the road. They've never been there. They simply think that the world ends on the farm. They don't understand that the world is full of people who are doing all sorts of things, and things are happening in the world. They never read a newspaper.
They simply don't know what's going on outside the boundaries of their farm, and they behave and act as if there is nothing outside their farm. And it was just amazing to me. So that passed. And then there was another problem in the town itself. And I caught myself in the middle of a sentence saying to a balabos in Stellenbosch in the town, "You know, you don't seem to realize that there's anything outside of Stellenbosch." Suddenly caught myself and said, "This sounds familiar." So there you've got a fellow who doesn't think there's anything outside of his farm. And is this one much better? He doesn't think there's anything outside of Stellenbosch. And I forgot that too. Then I found myself in a heated argument with a balabos in Cape Town. And again I caught myself in the middle of the sentence. This was months later. And I said, "Do you think that the world stops with the sea on that side and the mountains on that side?" All of a sudden I said, "So what's he any better?" So the first one thinks the world stops at his farm boundaries. The second one thinks Stellenbosch. The third one thinks Cape Town. They're all equally small. What's the difference? The fact is they don't know about the rest of the world. And then I stopped to think. And I said, "And people in Johannesburg? So they think that there's nothing beyond South Africa." This was a couple of years ago, before people were so preoccupied with emigration and things like that. And so one goes on. And Americans? Do Americans think that there's anything outside of America? That's it. They don't learn about it. They don't read about it. You must see what an American newspaper looks like. Even a good American newspaper. What an American TV show is like. I'll tell you that in California, you don't hear news of anything outside California. Except a little bit at election time, they tell you how the polls are going in other parts of the country. But that's all. The whole news, the television news, day and night, is California. Never mind United States. One finds that the whole world becomes very insular. And let's say that you've really got a universal human being. Smuts. Churchill. One of these big people who really see the world for what it is. And their vision, it also stops. So they see the globe. How big is the globe? In terms of outer space, in terms of reality of what it is, do they sit and think of the world as the oilam? The oilam being everything? Or do they still see the little globe as the world? That's as far as it goes. And you realize that even these big people, in terms of real bigness, are being insular. Now, spiritually, we have a similar concept. And that is, one has to realize that everything doesn't stop with our little world. And now by our little world, I'm referring to everything which is included in the first words of the Chumash as Oretz. Right? The physical universe. You've got to understand that that's not where it stops. That's not where it ends. That's just where it starts. That's the very beginning. For example, or let me put it to you one step further. We shouldn't think either that the world is broken up into many different worlds. But there's a physical, material world here in which we're occupied, and when we die, we go somewhere else to a spiritual world. We don't go anywhere else. We carry on living right here. The only difference is we carry on without our bodies. We carry on a spiritual plane. In other words, we mustn't see things as clearly separate items as a physical world and a spiritual world and a higher spiritual world and a higher spiritual world somewhere else. It's like an onion. You just take off the skin and there's another one underneath, and so it goes, it's all one onion. And so it is with all these worlds in which we operate. We're operating on a physical level, that everything we do is simultaneously a spiritual action. Not parallel to a spiritual action, but simultaneously a spiritual action. An example I gave once is the feeling, imagine a person goes into the control boards of a railway station, of a major railway junction. And the fellow tells him, "Well, you see, these lights represent a train which is travelling in this direction at such and such a speed, and these lights are another train. Now you'll see that the two trains will collide unless we change the points, so we do this, and you see the trains diverting all over the place," and he's fascinated. And he understands that there are real trains outside. And he understands that this is a board which is not a real train but represents a real train. But imagine if he doesn't understand the connection between the board and the real trains. And he says, "Let's have a bit of fun here. Let's see them collide a bit." He switches things the other way and he watches the collision. He doesn't understand what he's doing. He doesn't understand that although it's all just a little board and he's flicking switches, real things are happening. And we've got to understand that we, in a physical world, stand at a switchboard. We stand at a little control board where we're doing all sorts of things in a physical fashion, turning all sorts of switches and pressing all sorts of buttons. And every little thing we do is simultaneously an action in a spiritual sense. Now there are many, many chazals that we'll discuss sometime along this line that go further. What emerges from the chazal in fact is that spiritual things can be and are convertible into material and backwards and in the reverse as well. For example, you have various chazals which talk about tzaddikim being worried that they're receiving their olam haba on this world, that they're receiving their payments in the world to come, that they're receiving it on this world in the olam haba. How is it possible? How is it possible that spiritual payment, that spiritual pleasure, because the pleasure of olam haba, the pleasures of the world to come, is purely spiritual, there's absolutely nothing physical about it at all. How is it possible to be paid for that in this world? And in what sense? You talk about tzaddikim who found that they got a bit of money, or that they were financially comfortable, and they were worried that this was their olam haba. How can it be? The tells the Rav, and others bring many, many chazals to prove that in fact, one can transpose a physical thing into a spiritual thing. One can spiritualize the material and materialize the spiritual. There was a case, for example, where in the Midrash brings that there were a group of Talmidim were learning, and one of them went overseas, and he came back a wealthy man. He went over to do business, and he came back a wealthy man, and the yeshiva nearly collapsed. All the Talmidim wanted to go overseas. They said, let us go for a few years and we'll also get wealthy and we'll come back and learn. So the Rosh Yeshiva took them into a deep valley, and he prayed to the Ribbono Shel'olam. He says, please Ribbono Shel'olam, fill this valley with gold coins, kruger rands. And they came pouring, and the whole valley was full. He said, okay, anybody can take whatever they want, but you must know you're taking your olam haba. So everybody left it all there. And the Talmud Rav asked, what do you mean? What's it all talking about? But it is possible to take something which is spiritual and to make it, to give it a physical manifestation. The Medrash in Bereishis says that when it talks about certain parts of the world as being rich in gold, says the Medrash, that means Torah. Why does it mean Torah? Gold to the materialist is what Torah is to the spiritualist. And not just in as an image. In reality, you have the option. You can take your goods in gold or in Torah. They're convertible. The same as once upon a time, a rand and gold used to be convertible. They used to say on a rand note, I promise to pay the bearer of here 1 rand's worth of gold or whatever it is. Now they don't say that anymore. Now they just say, I promise to pay the bearer 1 rand. So you give him the paper, he'll give you another paper. It doesn't mean very much. But once upon a time, that used to be exchangeable for gold. Likewise, Torah and gold, it is the same thing. Not that gold can be compared to Torah in an allegoric sort of way. Torah can be materialized into gold. And that's what they did in that valley. He took the Torah, he took the schar of Torah, and he materialized it into gold. He says, this is what we're handling. Do you want it in this form, or do you want it in a spiritual form? What currency do you want it in? But it's the same thing, it's the same concept. What I've described is a very difficult concept, and we'll go into it deeply at another stage. But what we need to know simply at this stage is that when we see something operating in a material way, in a physical way, we're watching its spiritual operation as well. For example, you give a child some of these clever toys which they make. Triangles and circles and all sorts of things, and the child's supposed to put them together in some way or another. What are you really teaching the child? You're teaching the child geometry. You're familiarizing the child with certain geometrical relationships. Now that's not a way they would teach geometry in university, but it's the same geometry. It's exactly the same principles taught in a different way. We here are playing with the toys which teach us the same principles which exist as principles in the more spiritual world. We've got the physical manifestation of these things, but they're really the same spiritual concepts. And so, if you find that the Torah is taken out of the ark, and somebody goes up to the Torah and he kisses the Torah, that's not just a physical action, that a man kissed the Torah. That's a whole thing, a whole concept is going on. The soul of that man is relating in a spiritual way which can be compared to kissing with the essence of the Torah. Certainly if one does it with all one's heart, if one does it properly. It's not just a physical thing. Every physical thing we do is at the same time a spiritual thing. And therefore, if we see something and we give it a name, and we give it a name by something physical that it's doing, something material that it's doing, let's take Yaakov. Yaakov comes out holding onto Esau. That's not just coincidence. It didn't just happen that way. Because at that very time, Yaakov's soul was hanging onto Esau's soul. Everything that is happening physically is simultaneously happening spiritually. And therefore we have to take everything that happens physically very seriously. Nothing is by chance and nothing is to be taken on the surface. That is also the essence of the thing. And when Yaakov saw, when Yitzchak saw Yaakov holding onto the ankle of Esau, he realized that is the essence of Esau. As Hirsch translates those early psukim in the Chumash, Kol Asher Yikra Ha'adam, Loi Ha'adam, Nefesh Chaya. Anything which Adam, the human being, calls him, even though he's only a human being, since you're able to see how he functions in a human basis, Hushmoy, that is his essential name. So if Adam works out, for example, that an ox is very strong and powerful, and its function therefore is to pull, and he gives the ox a name which connotates pulling, it's not a superficial connotation, eh? That's in fact the essence of what the shor was really created for. He was created to pull. And if Adam figures out similarly with any other animal, that it has a certain function, and if one goes to the game reserve and one goes with somebody who knows and understands these things, they'll show you how each animal is constructed to fulfill its particular purpose. And when you see its material purpose, and you name it by its material purpose, that is also its spiritual purpose. The two are very closely linked and very closely related to one another. And Kol Asher Yikra Bo Ha'adam Nefesh Chaya, anything which man calls him, even though he's only a human being, Hush Shemoy, that is his essence, that is the name. And therefore when Yitzchak sees Yaakov holding onto the ankle of Esau, he realizes this isn't just a coincidence. That's his essence. He's always going to be hanging onto Esau. There are two things about hanging onto Esau's ankle. The one is that you're a noch schlepper, literally. You're hanging on, he's doing all the work and you're hanging on. And the other is it's very sly. That's an easy way to get out. You hang on and let the doctor pull him out, and you'll just come hanging on behind without having to do anything. It's clever on the point of being sly. And the word Yaakov or Akev has those very same two connotations. It comes from the word Akev, which means to hold on, and it comes from the word Akov, which means to be a little bit sly. Esav uses it later on. He says, "Vayakveni zeh pa'amayim," that Yaakov has cheated me twice. So you see that the word Yaakov has a connotation of being sly, and also of being a nochschlepper, a following. And that's exactly what Yitzchak calls him. He says, there's a concept here in this man of holding on to others, of coming behind, coming last, and there's also a concept of being sly. And maybe that's why Yitzchak took a dislike to Yaakov. Maybe that's why Yitzchak was sure that in essence Esav was the more superior man, that Esav was the leader. And as long as he could make Esav strong, and he could make Esav moral, Yaakov would follow. And that might be why Yitzchak dedicated all his educational strengths to improving Esav, who he believed was going to be the leader. And Yaakov would follow. We now understand how you can say that it was God, in fact, who gave him the name Yaakov. God gave him the name Yaakov not because he was holding on to his brother's ankle, but he was holding on to his brother's ankle because God gave him the name Yaakov. When God called him Yaakov, he's calling him Yaakov because that is his essence, and it will express itself in all sorts of physical ways. Although his spiritual essence is Yaakov, that will express itself in all sorts of physical ways. One of them is at the very moment of birth, when he's holding onto his brother's ankle. That's Yaakov. So we see that names are terribly deep things, that one has to try it when naming. Yaakov had to try, Yitzchak had to try, Adam had to try, God, when he was giving the names to those first five items, tried to name them as far as possible according as the Sipurnu says to their pu'ula hamayuchedes l'tzuroso, to the function unique to that particular object, That's what a name is. A name is what differentiates you from somebody else. There's a whole crowd of people, I must be able to say one name, and one person gets up, not everybody. That's what a shame is. It's that which makes you different from everybody else. But not just as a label that's tagged onto you. Because then we could just give each other numbers. And you number 463, and then his number 7983, and everybody's got their number, and everybody's different. That's not what a name is. A name is, in fact, a description of the essential uniqueness of each individual. That's what a shame is. That's why one has to be so careful in the selection of a name. But more important, one also has to understand that naming is not only naming one's children. Naming is naming situations, putting one's finger on what things are, understanding what is. And in everything that we look at, we've got to understand the uniqueness of that particular thing, what makes that different from everything else. Because if one doesn't understand that, one doesn't understand the object. If that's the case, that Yaakov was named by the Ribbono Shel Olam, and even if he wasn't named by the Ribbono Shel Olam, if he was named only by Yitzchak, but the name was an essential quality, it was describing who he really was, and the naming fits now according to the definition of what a name should be, the definition given to us by the Sipurna in Bereishis chapter 2, why did they change his name? I could understand if Yaakov was just a superficial name given to him afterwards. Comes the time, God says, okay, now you need a real name. But if that was his essence, was Yaakov, why is it changed to Yisrael in the middle? And if he was changed to Yisrael, why do we still call him Yaakov? Avram was changed to Avraham, and one isn't allowed to call him Avram. Sarai was changed to Sarah, and one isn't allowed to call her Sarai. But Yaakov, we still call it Elokeinu, Elokei Avosenu, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. We say three times a day in our davening, not Elokei Yisrael. But we call ourselves Bnei Yisrael. What is it? Is it Yaakov or is it Yisrael? Let's assume that his essential character was Yaakov. Yaakov was best suited to fight Esav. Because what was Esav's essential quality? He fooled everybody from the day he was born. They thought he was complete. Looked like a mensch, Esau. He looked like the leader. He fooled his own father. He used to ask the most frum sorts of shilas. And I always make the point, and people have to understand, don't picture Esau the way they describe him in nursery schools and in Bible classes, as some kind of wild animal that used to run around in a safari suit with his shirt open down to his belly button. Don't picture him like that at all. He wasn't. I assure you that if Esav was living in society today, and Esav at this moment walked in, when it's bad enough, if anybody walks in late, everybody takes a look to see who he is. But quite apart from that, if Esav walked in, everybody would stand up. No question. Be a man who would walk in with a long black coat, serious face, long ginger beard, a big hat, walk in, everybody would stand up. Offer him a seat up at the front, everybody would be terribly taken up. He used to ask the kind of shilas, he used to discuss learning with his father in an extreme sort of way. He was an extremist. He was meshuga frum. Esav, in the discussions he had with his father, was meshuga frum. But in his heart, nothing. And we like to look at Esav as a character, some kind of stranger we look at, you know, Esav, and we all point a finger at him. But Esav is a character who is becoming more and more real in modern religious life. Because we're beginning to define religiousness by means of a very superficial system of criteria. And if one qualifies with all these things, then one is religious and you can do anything. And if you don't qualify, then you're irreligious, and whatever you do, you're irreligious. That's beginning to be the mentality of a religious outlook. And one's beginning to find that among religious people, It's tragic that it has come to a stage where one has to say such things, that among religious people, honesty is becoming a problem. So really, honesty cannot be taken for granted among religious people anymore. How is that possible? That honesty, the basis, yashra, straightness of any basis of religiousness, can't be taken for granted. That means you can have a man who can come in, as I described him. His name might not be Esav, his name might be Rabbi somebody else, with a long coat and a big black hat and a long beard. And you can't assume that the man is honest. You can't necessarily trust him. Do you know what that means? But he complies to the rules and regulations. He does what you have to do to be called frum. You have a situation where a concert is given and the music is nightclub music. The words are from the Chumash. The music is nightclub music and the body movements are Elvis Presley. But it's frum, it's a Jewish concert, frum concert. Never mind a Jewish concert, it's okay. Because everything, it all fits the criteria. How can that be? We're beginning to find that we're confusing ourselves as to what it means to be frum. And we're thinking that as long as it looks right, and as long as the basic things are done right, that's frum. One can get drunk, one can use... One can mistreat one's wife, one can be coarse, one can eat without bad table, with bad table manners. That's all okay. It doesn't say anywhere that you can't do those things. As long as one does, keeps Shabbos, keeps kashrus, looks the part, plays the part, acts the part, that's an asim. So we're beginning to find ourselves in a situation where we don't know quite what it is to be frum and what it isn't to be frum. One has to understand also that when the Torah talks about problems of soita, for example, what is a soita? A soita is a man who suspects that his wife is having an affair. Who's the Torah talking about? Is the Torah talking about irreligious people? No. Because it says that you must bring your wife to the Kohen Gadol and the matter must be investigated. Would irreligious people take their wives to the Kohen Gadol? No. They would take their wives to their lawyers. That's what they would do. So when the Torah talks about a soita as being somebody, if there is such a problem, you go to the Kohen Gadol and this is what you do, etc., etc., they're talking about religious people. So there is the concept, theoretically, at least in the Torah theoretically, that you can have a religious society that has problems of marital infidelity, of prostitution, of theft. Chas v'shalom, but one just thinks that it doesn't happen. But not anymore. Today these are problems within religious societies. And marriage breakdowns are problems within religious societies. And they're not marriage breakdowns because the marriage was no good to start off with. They're marriage breakdowns because they don't know how to relate to each other like human beings, never mind like the Bnei Torah. And you've got a whole situation where the atmosphere of Torah, where the soul of Torah, where what Torah is all about is no longer a requirement of being frum. I'll go even further and I'll say, how long did it take Rabbi Akiva to become a Baal Tshuva? 24 years. He went away for 12 years, came back and he heard that his wife wouldn't mind him going away for another 12 years, went away for another 12 years. It took him 24 years to become a Baal Tshuva. And so with many others. A few years ago, 10, 20 years ago, it used to take 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. Today it's instant. Simple. Because what is there to becoming a Baal Tshuva? What is there? If you didn't used to be frum and you want to become frum, what do you have to do? You start keeping Shabbos, eating kashrus, and wearing a couple of things, and doing a few things. Is it so difficult? Why did it take Rabbi Akiva 24 years if it's so easy? Why did it used to take 15, 20, 25 years if it was so easy? 5 years? 3 years? If it can be done in one moment, why is it so new that it's being done in one moment? It can't be done in one moment. To achieve the understanding of what Torah really demands of a human being, to achieve the understanding and the ability to practice the neshama of Torah, the values of Torah, to develop the character that Torah requires, and that's the essence of it. To make a Torah personality out of a human being, not just doing things. To change oneself is what is required. Who can change oneself in one moment? It's not possible. So Esav is a very modern character, and one with whom I have a very interesting relationship. He's not a distant sort of guy that I read about. He's the guy we have to deal with. He's real. Esav is the man who would fool any of us as being the essence of frumkeit. He fooled Yitzchak. So that's the essence of Esav. He's a man who is a con man. He knows all the tricks. He knows what to say. He knows what to do. And nothing for himself. For example, he saw that his father got married at the age of 40, so he got married at the age of 42. I do what my father did. Tradition, you know. to family. My father, after all, was the son of Avraham Avinu. This is a tradition. He didn't get married till 40. I don't get married until I'm 40. And people used to offer him shidduchim. Esav, we've got this wonderful girl for you. Sorry, until I'm 40. My father, respect for my father, would never do it. What was he doing during those 40 years? Running after people who weren't his wife. That Yitzchak used to do. That doesn't matter. People didn't know about that. That wasn't done in public. So in public, the image is, I don't get married till I'm 40 because I follow in my father's footsteps. And in private, the image is, I do what I damn well like. And that's what we've got today in Frum society. There's a certain public image, but in terms of internal character building, I'm just my same old self. And that's not Torah. And how do you fight an Esav? That's one of the problems. You can't fight him. Because he doesn't come out into the open. It's like guerrilla warfare. It's frightening. Guerrilla warfare is always successful. No army can beat guerrilla warfare. Because you can't confront them. You don't know who they are. I remember when I used to go visiting up in Rhodesia, as it was called at the time. They used to tell me what the problem, the difficulty is. As you drive through Salisbury, he might be a terrorist, he might be one, he might be one, he one might be one, the boy working in the office might be one, your own domestic servant might be one. You can't throw them out because you don't know that they're one. You can't trust them because maybe they're one. That's the terrible thing. That's what's eating people up at that time, that you just don't know who your enemy is. That's how it is with Esav. We don't know who they are. They don't come out into the open. How do you fight them? You need Yaakov. You need to be a little bit sly. You need to fight them on their own grounds, because otherwise you can't confront them. And it's interesting to see that Yaakov does it successfully. He gets the brachas Yaakov gets the brachas from Esav. Steals the rights of the brachas from Esav in a roundabout fashion. And he achieves it through a way which could be called Okav. It's not quite straight. It's acceptable halachically and so on and so forth, but it's not the way Yaakov would have liked to have done it, I assure you. Yaakov himself didn't feel pleased about it. Rivka had to push him into it. It's not the way he would have liked to have done it, but he did it. That was his speciality. And only a man who knew how to fight indirectly, in a snide sort of way, could possibly counteract an Esav. Because you can only fight an Esav with that little bit of slyness. You can't confront him openly, because you'll never catch him. And Lavan, the same thing. Lavan's a sly Christian. Openly, Lavan was wonderful. Benevolent, generous. It was always in a sly way where you could never catch him. That's where he was, Lavan. And Yaakov manages to beat Lavan as well. But he beats him using his Yaakov talents, using his Yaakov abilities. We said there were two connotations in the word Yaakov, the slyness and the following on. He's got rid of the first connotation already. He no longer follows. He's overtaken Esav. He's overtaken Lavan. He's put them behind him. But still, it's not in a straight confrontation way. Finally, Yaakov is ready to confront Esav on Yaakov's terms, openly. And he meets him by Yivotza Yaakov Lavada, and Yaakov is on his own. By Ye'ovek Ish Imai, and a man battles with him. And Chazal tell us that that is Soro Shel Esav. See in a moment what that is. Ab Alois Hashokal, until the morning. What does the Soro Shel Esav mean, the angel of Esav? Again, the same concept. Everything has its physical form and has its spiritual forms. And it's not separate and different. This was the spiritual form of Esav. This was not Esav the man. Esav the man is still waiting. But it's everything that Esav represents embodied in a physical form. In the same way as you can take Torah and turn it into gold, and you can take an angel and give him the form of a man, so you can take the concept of Esav and put him into a physical embodiment, and there he is. He's a man. He appears to be a man. He's a malach, but in the full appearance in the full physical appearance of a man. And Yaakov understands he's now got to take Esav on openly. They're fighting. Physical fighting. One has to beat the other. Esav is saying to Yaakov, none of the snideness. You started from the day we were born, holding on to my ankle. Very clever. And then you cheated me out of the brachas. And then you slipped away to Uncle Lover. And you always managed to slip out of my fingers. Now we're going to confront each other openly and physically. And Yaakov is terrified. What does he do? They fight until the morning. Vayar ki lo yochel lo, and the angel Esav realizes that he can't beat Yaakov. But it doesn't say that Yaakov won either. So who won? Nobody won. But Yaakov won. He won by sticking around. Just waiting. That's all. He knew that he wasn't going to be able to beat Esav, because Esav is stronger. To physically beat Esav, he couldn't do. To use slyness, he couldn't do either. This is open combat. All he has to do is sustain himself. Keep going until Alois HaShacha, until the sun comes up. Why? Because when the sun comes up, Esav will run. Esav doesn't stick around when the lights are on, because that would show him up. And Esav feels uncomfortable when the lights are on. And Esav only feels comfortable in the darkness. And Yaakov knew, if I can just maintain my position until the morning, I'll wear him out. He'll have to leave me alone. And that's in fact what happens. Comes the morning, the angel says, let me go. Why? Not because you've beaten me, but because the light is coming. I can't be here when it's light. Now Yaakov says, oh no, you wait here until I'm finished with you. Now Yaakov overcomes Esav. But it's not with his own strength that he overcomes Esav. It's by turning on the light that he overcomes Esav. There's an incredible concept here. There's only one way to handle an Esav, and that's to have clarity. Esavs thrive in ignorance. They thrive in communities where there's ignorance. They thrive when they themselves are ignorant. They thrive in darkness, in intellectual darkness, where people don't know. That's when they thrive. When there's knowledge, when there's clarity, an Esav can't exist. An Esav will fight with a Yaakov in the nighttime. A Yaakov just has to wait until it gets daytime. Until the light is on and things can be seen in their correct perspective, then a Yaakov knows that he's won, because an Esav can't survive in the daytime. An Esav is terrified of the day. So what has happened here? Yaakov has got rid of both of his shortcomings, or his strengths. He's not following on Esav anymore. And he's not being sly anymore. He's able to overcome Esav in full open combat. How did he do it? By understanding what Esav is. Until now he thought Esav is a force that has to be fought on his own terms. And he used to fight Esav in a sly fashion. And each time he got away with it. But he didn't beat Esav to the point where there was no longer a problem. Esav was still there after Yaakov's blood. But this time he manages to destroy Esav totally. Why? Because he understood what the name Esav meant. Esav! He fooled everybody when he came out of his mother's womb. How did they name him? By his most superficial covering, because he had a head of hair. They called him Esav. And he's carried on fooling people with his external manifestation all the time. With his coat of fur. That's what's been fooling people. Says Yaakov, if that's what it is, all we need is the light. All we need is a bit of reality, a bit of perspective. We'll show him up for what he really is, and that will kill him. That's the end of him. And here we see, number one, that Yaakov overcame his weakness. I'll say more about that in a moment. But that he overcame the weakness by clarity. What we see, in fact, is something unbelievable, something very encouraging, and something that places tremendous demands on every single one of us. We said a name describes the essence. And we said even if you name something after its superficial appearance, as long as it's something unique. Right? For a twin to come out holding onto his brother's ankle, that's unique. It's superficial but unique. That doesn't matter. As long as it's unique, as long as that is what typifies this particular individual, and you name him after that, you're hitting the essence. That's what he really is. He's a Yaakov. So much so that Chazal say God gave him that name or agreed with that name. Yaakov is what he really was. After the fight, the angel says to him, Mashmecha, what's your name? Vayomer Yaakov. He says, my name is Yaakov, says the angel. Lo Yaakov Yayomer Ad Shimcha. No longer will your name be said as Yaakov, ki im Yisroel. You're now a fighter. You're a master. You're a prince. Because you have dominated God and men. God in terms of the angel, which is something that God sent, and men, Esav and Lavan, Batuchal, and you've been able to. have you been able to, not by Yaakov, not by being sly, not by hanging on, you're no longer Yaakov in the sense that you hang on, you're now a tsar, you're a leader. And you didn't beat them by sly methods, you beat them in the open. Vatuchal, you were able to cope with them in the open. In Elohim v'Adam, God himself you took on, and you were successful. Therefore you're not to be called Yaakov anymore, you're to be called Yisroel. Yaakov has completely broken down the natural barriers of his birth, the natural barriers that were imposed by his own personality. He's exceeded, he's gone far beyond that. One of the problems with modern educationalists and psychologists and with ourselves is that we start off with an assumption that we have certain limitations. And that assumption is wrong. We don't have limitations. We have a spark of godliness which, if correctly built up and utilized, enables us to go far beyond our limitations. Certainly it's hard. The Rambam says everybody has limitations, each person in different directions. And each person's nisyonos are easy in some and difficult in others. So let's take our early examples. You have a man who's generous. For him it's easy to give charity. That's not what the big difficulty is. For him it's more difficult to save money for a project. That's important. That's his nisyon. You have a man who's an extrovert, so for him it's not difficult to do chesed. That's not his big nisyon. For him it's difficult to sit down and learn a black gemara. That's what's hard for him. You have another man who's an introverted academic. For him to sit and learn about Gemara is not a nisoyon. For him the nisoyon is to go out and do some chesed and to relate to people. But the danger is that people start saying to themselves, well, I'm just a happy-go-lucky extrovert. I don't have a mind for learning Gemara. I'll do chesed and things like that. That's how I'll serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. No. You have a man who says, I'm an academic. I sit and learn. I don't have to worry about doing chesed and kindness. That's not my scene. No. Sure, everybody has an area of speciality. Everybody has an area of major strength which they have to build on and utilize. But let nobody use as an excuse to themselves or to others that they have inherent personality limitations. Because at Yaakov we start building the people of Israel. Until Yaakov, God wasn't prepared to start building. Avram, one child, Yitzchak. Yitzchak, one child, Yaakov. Yaakov, now we're ready to go. And he calls him Yisroel, the name which the nation is going to carry on afterwards. And what did we say a name is? It's that which typifies the thing, the uniqueness of the thing. So what's unique about Yisroel, about Israel, about Am Yisroel? What's unique is Yisroel, their ability to change themselves from a Yaakov to a Yisroel. The ability to change their very inherent nature from one of limitations. Yaakov, Akev, hanging on to Yisroel, to dominance, to nobility. That's the essence of a Jew. He can break his barriers. He can break his limitations. And that's what Yaakov in fact succeeded in doing. That's what Yaakov managed to achieve. This is something that is terribly encouraging, because one of the frustrations is, as one grows and one feels oneself reaching one's limitations, one starts reaching a point where the next step you would like to take is really beyond you. The first stages of progress are just doing those things which are relatively easy for one to do. But then one gets to the stage where you want to take another step, but it's against your nature. It's not a natural step to be able to take. There comes a time when the extrovert has to put his nose down into a piece of Gemara. There comes a time when the academic has to get up and be social. It's not something which he naturally wants to do. It's not something that he naturally feels comfortable about doing, but it's something which he has to do. And to know that not only is that possible, but that's what being Jewish is something encouraging and important. But just to conclude, how do you do it? Very easy. Just know what you're dealing with. That's all. Clarity. Know where you're going. Know where you're trying to get. Define it. Have it clear. Give it a name. A shame. Define its uniqueness. Why you want to get to that particular point. What you want to achieve. Spell it out in words. Say it out to yourself aloud. Make sure that it's real. Make sure that you know where you're going. And make sure that along the path you know what you're dealing with. The essence to a successful life is this very concept that we've been talking about. Shameless. Just to understand what things are. To understand their names. To know that a door is not a wall, and a wall is not a door. Therefore you know that if there's a door which is open, you don't have the same security as if there wasn't a door. And if you want to walk through a place, don't try walking through the wall. Walk through the door. You've got to know that's a door and that's a wall. And likewise with everything we handle and with everything you do. We have to know what a father is, what a mother is, what a son is, what a daughter is, what a husband is, what a wife is, what a brother is, what a sister is, what a home is, what a meal is, what a benching is, what a brocha is, what a davening is, what a tefillin is, what a motor car is, what one's work is, what an employer is, what an employee is, what a poor man is, what a rich man is, what tzedakah is, what chesed is. All these things that we're using, we have to understand. Can you imagine the destruction in the world if people used tools that they didn't understand? If people were permitted to walk around with guns and they didn't know what a gun was? Or were permitted to drive motor cars and they didn't know what a motor car was? Can you imagine what destruction? And so we go about using things all the time, using concepts, using ideas, using people, using situations, without understanding their shameless, without understanding what they are in unique essence, what they really are. That can be very dangerous. The moment Yaakov was able to realize what Esav was, Esav is a hairy beast. He's managed to fool everybody. They've been fooled by his hair. Turn on the lights, everybody, and you'll see who Esav really is. That's how we finish off Esav. As long as that can be done, Yaakov doesn't have to handle it in a sly way. You only have to handle things in a sly way where you don't know what they are and where you don't know what you're dealing with. But when you know with clarity what you're dealing with and you know how to set about handling with it, it's easy to do. What one has to do is one has to see that everybody understands for themselves what their strengths and weaknesses are. We said there's one strength, one weakness. Everybody has to know what their area of strength and weakness is. And they have to know that the area of strength is not an excuse to ignore the areas of weakness. The areas of strength have to be used as a mechanism, as a means, as a tool to build up the areas of weakness and to conquer those weaknesses until they're utterly obliterated, until one doesn't have those weaknesses anymore. One has to change from a Yaakov into a Yisrael. Although Yaakov was his essential personality changed to a Yisrael through his own work and his own effort. The second thing is one has to know when one has understanding of one's strengths and weaknesses, has to know where one's trying to go, what one's trying to change. And the third thing is one has to know what route one's going to take, what one's going to do to try and affect those changes. And if one can't do those things by themselves, I'm sorry to say that psychologists can't help, and educationists can't help. That's something that only a rock can help with. Because one's dealing with Torah. One's dealing with a definition of what things really are and where one's really going. And if necessary, one has to consult with a rock, make sure that one understands these areas of strength and weaknesses, where we're going to go, and then take the steps to build up and break out of those barriers which everybody must feel are restricting him and containing him. Break those barriers down and reach into new areas which one thought a while back were completely beyond one's reach, because they're not in accordance with one's basic personality. But even though they're not in accordance with one's basic personality, it doesn't mean that they're beyond one's reach. On the contrary, it's the essence of being Jewish to reach beyond one's reach and to achieve those things which initially appear to be beyond one's reach.